Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest in our series of spoiler special podcasts. We said for a while now that we would try to record a spoiler special dedicated to the second season of Marvel and Netflix's Daredevil, and here we are. And by here I mean, of course, the cold, soulless environs of the Empire Pod booth, and by we, I mean myself, Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
And John Nugent.
Hello.
How are you all?
Good, thank you.
Good.
Excellent, excellent. Glad to hear it. Over the next hour or so, we'll be discussing and assessing the ins and outs, the ups and downs, the twists and turns, the billy clubs and the bullets of the second season of Daredevil. Which means, as ever, on a spoiler special, if you haven't seen the show and you don't want to know what happens, stop listening now. And then come back to us when you've watched all 13 episodes. Actually, that doesn't work because they've stopped listening, so they haven't heard me say that,
oh,
so they
no,
don't know to come back.
You should have led with that, Chris.
Okay, that's a schoolboy error. I apologize. But before we get into Daredevil Season 2, we're going to hear first from the Devil of Hell's Kitchen himself and the deadly assassin who stole his heart. I caught up with Charlie Cox, who plays, of course, Matt Murdock and the Daredevil, and Elodie Young, who plays Electronachios, when they were in Paris last week. We talked about a lot of the spoilerific stuff that happens to both our characters in this season. Of course, they're not the showrunners. They're not involved in creative decisions. So I kept my questions purely focused on character issues. And I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that we didn't get a chance to cover in our allotted time, but I hope you enjoy this, as there's a lot of interesting areas covered here. Enjoy.
So let's talk about Daredevil Season 2. Let's get into spoilers right away. Charlie, you don't read the scripts.
I read the scripts.
Obviously, you read the scripts.
Hang on a second. Massive accusation there. I'm just lazy. I show up, I don't know anything. I don't read the Bible in advance.
Okay.
So I read the scripts as they are sent to me.
Okay.
Episodically.
I didn't mean to imply that you improvised the entire thing. It's all your genius. So I guess you get surprised the same way the audience gets surprised.
That's the idea behind it, yeah.
So, for example, when Wilson Fisk shows up.
Yes.
How much let me tell you
what I knew is okay. That I got a text around about episode 5 of season 2 from Vincent saying, "Hey buddy, how's it going?" Oh. Actually, it wasn't that. He sends me these. Do you know that Dub Smash? You know Dub Smash?
Yeah,
we did one for him, right? So he Dub Smash. So he sends me these periodically. He just sends me a random Dub Smash, which I find really funny.
Vincent D'Onofrio
send him back. I reply with Elodie and I sent him one back.
Okay.
So he sent me a Dub Smash, and then he said, you know, by the way, how's it going? You know, how are you feeling? Blah, blah, blah. And I wrote, you know, it's great. It's busy this year. I'm in every day at the moment, and it's really good fun, but it's hard work, you know, taking a beating because there was a lot of fighting at one point of that show. And he wrote back and said, well, I'll be there to help you out in a couple of months or a couple of weeks or something. And I was like, oh, interesting. He didn't know that I didn't know, you know. So that was very exciting. I got a similar shock that hopefully the audience would have got.
It's fantastic moments. And Fisk's appearances are great. Elodie, do you read the scripts in advance, or are you like Charlie here? Do you get them as they arrive, or do you like to know what happens?
What did I do for the show? Well, you know, Marvel is very secretive, so I didn't torture the showrunner, but I would ask questions and just try to have more clues of what would come next, because they didn't deliver the full season at first. You know, they give us a few episodes in advance, but you don't have everything in advance. So I try to know a little bit in advance just to figure out a bit about Elektra a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And then I can be sometimes, I have to admit, a bit lazy. So I, you know, I'd read the scripts, but very quickly, and then would focus more on, you know, because also on this show it goes very fast, faster than in a movie. So I really wanted to focus on the relationships that Elektra has with Matt Murdock, you know, things like this. So when I watched the show, because I was a fan of season 1, and so I discovered a few things when I watched the show.
But I do remember a conversation that you and I had at some point where you knew stuff that I didn't know coming up.
And I would not tell you because you didn't want to. Yeah.
So you're the opposite of a spoiler junkie. You just do not want to know anything at all.
The idea behind it is that as I read these episodes episodically as they come in, I'm reading them, I'm experiencing them in the same way that an audience will experience them, the spoilers specifically.
Sure.
So hopefully that informs performance in some way.
absolutely. Well, we'll talk about the relationship between Elektra and Matt in a second. But Elodie, you just called Matt Murdock, Matt Murdock.
Yeah, that's
which is the first time
right.
I've ever heard you say the word Matt Murdock.
And as I was saying it, I was like, why am I calling him Matt Murdock? It's the first time. I don't know why. Maybe it's because it's been a little while since I've been on the show. Now, you know, we've finished in December. And then since last month when we were doing the promotion, I would always say Matthew, you know, in my interviews. But maybe there's like, it's kind of a distance now. So now he's this character, Matt Murdock. You're nothing to me now. Nothing to me anymore.
So where did the Matthew thing come from?
The Matthew?
Yeah, the decision to have Elektra call Matthew.
I think
even I'm doing it now.
It's cool, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Very cool.
And also stick calling me Matty.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was something I think that was discussed earlier when I was auditioning, I guess, with the showrunners. They liked this idea that the way she would call him would be a bit different from the other characters calling Matt Murdock and to create an intimacy, I guess. You know, he's Matthew for her. Mm. They met when they were younger and they had a love story and he would always remain Matthew for her.
Absolutely. It's a very, very complex relationship, to say the least.
Yeah.
Between
relationships are complex. Like yeah. Most of the time, actually, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's in some ways it's very complex. I think in other ways it's very, very simple as well.
Well, this one has more killer ninjas than most relationships.
Yeah.
Certainly in my experience.
And a different kind of foreplay as well.
Yeah. Precisely. But how would you categorize it? I mean, I spoke to you on set, I think back in October, Charlie, and you talked about Elektra being this sort of the dangerous ex that you know you should walk away from, but you really can't. There's something compelling about her as a character for Matt.
Yes.
I'm really sorry you experienced this. Yeah. Charlie, in your life.
You know, I think it's a metaphor in many ways. You know, it's a heightened world. You know, I like to joke, but also comment, I guess is the word, that, you know, I know a lot of my guy friends will identify with this relationship, with a relationship like this. Usually, hopefully, happens earlier on in one's life. Mm-hmm. In this case, obviously, they met in college when they were in their early 20s and is incredibly, you know, probably a first great love, you know, incredibly passionate, incredibly exciting, also very destructive and detrimental to each other's, you know, individuality, etc. And they kind of get wrapped up in each other and they take over their city in their mind, or they take over their campus or whatever it is. And it's just a very, you know, traditional love-hate relationship. The difference being, of course, with these two is that they know advanced forms of karate and jiu-jitsu and capoeira and those kind of things, Muay Thai. So the hate part of their relationship is quite violent.
Obviously, then there are all sorts of motivations for why Elektra comes back into Matthew's life. But ultimately, in your opinion, Elodie, does love drive Elektra? Is she still in love with Matt from the beginning?
I think there's two things, really. You know, she needs him as... She needs him for her mission. Mm-hmm. He's the best fighter. She knows. She says it in, you know, at some point. She's like, you know, you're the best in town. I need you. Or you're the best lawyer. Mm. That's a lie at the beginning. But, you know, he's the best. She needs him as a tool, you know, as a good tool, as a good weapon.
Yeah.
So the practical side of her brain's like, okay, I need the guy. But also, I think she really misses him. Mm. Because Elektra says it, you know, she says, do you believe it? If I said I missed you, and then he's like, yeah, whatever. And she's like, haha, yeah, of course, no, I didn't. But I think she did.
Yeah.
I think she was honest when she said that. And, you know, it's kind of a, yes, love and hate relationship, but I think she's only loved him.
Mm.
She decided to stop everything because then, you know, when she offered Roscoe to Matthew, then, and he refused to kill him, then she understood that they were not on the same page. Mm. And that really deeply hurt her. Mm. But I don't think she's ever hated Matthew.
Mm.
And then all these years, she's been lonely because he probably was the only one who would feel the gap. And so when she comes back, she needs him, but she also missed him.
I think, tell me what you think, Elektra, but
I've got my size in my purse.
You think this is true.
You did improvise this, girl.
I also feel like she knows beyond a shadow of a doubt that she can trust him.
Yeah.
That he's loyal.
Mm-hmm.
And that he is particularly loyal to her, I think. She knows that regardless of how well he takes the news that she's back in his life, I think she knows that he will not betray her.
And what it leads to, ultimately, obviously, there's this very, very interesting love triangle between characters. Karen and Matt and Elektra, even though Karen doesn't necessarily know she's part of the love triangle, that leads to the decision in the final episode where Matt and Elektra say, okay, once we get through this, if we get through this, let's leave together, let's be together. How genuine do you think that decision was?
Oh man, that's a great question. I mean, I really had a lot of, we had a lot of conversations about this right up until the day we were shooting it, and I was still sitting down with Marco Ramirez, was on set that day, one of the showrunners, and
I wasn't part of the conversation.
Yeah, you were. Do you remember we had to stop? We actually stopped filming for a minute. We came downstairs and we sat in around three chairs. They built that structure, do you remember?
And we were still
figuring out, like, just to make sure that we were clear about A, what we were saying, and B, what was really meant, you know. I'm almost hesitant to answer because I think I really do think I want people to kind of draw their own conclusions from that moment, because it's tricky because I don't think he's disingenuous. I really don't think he's, but I it's almost like I would say that he allows himself to engage in that fantasy and enjoys the engagement in that fantasy momentarily partly because of what they're up against, because he knows what's behind that door. And if they were to survive it, if they were both to have survived that encounter, would he have followed through with it? I don't know. I honestly don't know. But in the moment before they open the door, he can't help himself but just allow himself to enjoy that fantasy, enjoy those feelings.
And I think she does the same as well. She's like, for a moment, she wants to believe that they will go hand in hand and, you know, but we know that we're going to die. That's not possible.
The tricky thing was also shooting that. I did know the scene that I had coming up with Deborah.
Of course, yeah.
And what was really important to me from Matt's journey point of view was that he wasn't making this promise, making this commitment to Elektra. And then when that fails, he goes to Karen.
Yes.
That was really...
As a plan B.
As a kind of a plan B.
As a fallback.
As like a fallback plan. Yeah. That was really important to me because in my heart, I think that Karen Page is Matt Murdock's true love, great love, the love of his life.
Yeah.
I think what we see in season two is him coming to the understanding that he's too complicated for her. He would never choose Matt for her. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
He loves her too much, I think. Mm. And she represents a purity and a something that I don't think he thinks he deserves for himself. So when he goes to Karen at the end of the second season and he presents this mask and he says, this is who I am, I'm Daredevil. I think what he's doing, I think the subtext under that is, I have no idea how we go forward from here. I have no idea what's on the cards for us. I have no idea if I can make up for the deceit and the lies and the dishonesty, if any of the damage can be repaired. But I know that if we're to have any sort of a chance of that event of that, I know that it has to start with me telling you who I am.
Yeah.
You knowing the whole everything about who Matt Murdock is, who Daredevil is. And so really, hopefully, what the end of season two represents is a beginning.
That's what I find really interesting about this season, actually, in that it presents Matt, it has the confidence to present Matt as an imperfect character, as someone who makes bad decisions. Even something as small as going to the prison to confront Fisk
is a terrible, terrible decision. Egoic decision. That's one thing I love about Matt is these terrible decisions are coming out of his pride and his ego.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these very human traits.
Was that interesting to you that the showrunners allowed you to push it in that direction, or they pushed it in that direction themselves? They presented him as a man who's trying to be heroic, but in doing so, sometimes fails in it.
I mean, I think I almost based everything, you know, obviously I've ultimately taken everything from the comics when I can. But when I was preparing for the character, the thing that I kept going back to since the beginning of season one was the very end of the opening sequence in season one.
Sure.
When he's on the docks with the people traffickers and Turk Barrett. And it's said in the script, you know, Turk pulls a gun, he backflips over him, he kicks the gun away, he punches him in the face or whatever it was, and then he goes, and he keeps punching, and he keeps punching, and he keeps punching. And it literally said that in the script. And I remember reading that and thinking, whoa, this is a superhero. That's interesting.
Yeah.
The guy's down. He's done. Mission accomplished. He keeps going.
Because it's a fine line between someone who won't kill, but someone who will happily ally himself with people who will, like Elektra and Frank at the end. Obviously, he's quite happy to get the assist on the roof from the Punisher.
Yeah, happily being the operative word. Happily / kind of, you know, coerced into it, manipulated into it, you know, needs it.
But,
Yeah.
Not going to say no, obviously, if someone's going to take out some ninjas. Yeah. Elodie, very, very quickly about Elektra in this. So many questions that I'm sure you don't have the answers to at this point in time. But when did you know that Elektra was Black Sky? And what does that mean to you? Because the show doesn't necessarily spell out what Black Sky is.
You know, they didn't give us the full scripts. They didn't give us the whole season written.
They do give us the full scripts. Just
full, full scripts, but not the full season.
Okay.
So
it's not vital words.
I had ideas. I had ideas because I would always, Charlie doesn't want to know anything, and I like to play detective, so I would ask questions to the showrunner and you know, just try to figure out where they were kind of going. So I had an idea that, you know, they might go in this direction, but I also wanted to keep the surprise and keep some stuff fresh, just for the sake of, you know, it's for her, you know, she discovers that she's the Black Sky and it's a surprise and it's, you know, it's everything, it's her world collapsing. And so for an acting point of view, I didn't want to know exactly in details what was going on, so I didn't know exactly.
Do you have any ideas of what it might be? This is something mystical?
No, of course, yes. Yeah. And, you know, I absolutely have ideas. I do.
I don't know where
they're going to go, but Elektra dies at the end, and then she comes back in the comics, so hopefully I'll be back.
Like you haven't already got the call.
No, I don't know anything.
I started off talking about the arrival of Wilson Fisk in this sequence and the moment where Matt goes to see him at the prison. That was terrifying. The rage that Vincent D'Onofrio works himself up into as he slams your head off the table. What was it like for you?
What's the best word? I mean, it's such a pleasure working with him. Like, I go into a day of work with him and I know I'm going to learn something. I know I'm going to see something I haven't seen before. Mm-hmm. And that was, again, another one of those days where, you know, I don't want to say too much about his process because it's not really my place to share that. But what I will say is that when it came to his coverage of that, when they turned the camera around onto him, I overheard him say to the director something like, keep rolling, don't cut. I'm going to go in and out a little bit, but you'll get everything you need. And the director was like, okay. I've actually utilized what he did that day since then, both on Daredevil and on another project that I did. And, you know, really what he did was he didn't worry about whether the scene played as a whole. And I guess it comes from being immensely experienced. He probably went over the whole scene two or three times in its entirety, but not consecutively. He went back on himself and over again, and then he kind of walked away from the table at one point, and he came back, and he started a bit further back. And my job in that moment, I was just aware that the camera was on him, and I was just going to be present with him for the entire time. Like, you know, and just wherever he picked up, I was trying to be with him.
Oh wow! Okay.
And it was, you know, it was spectacular. I mean, he worked himself up into such a rage and such a, you know, a visceral. It was like you could feel it. And he smacked me on the table pretty damn hard. You know what I mean? You know. A friend of mine watched that episode recently, and they said, "What at the end when you're struggling so much, when he's shouting at you, is he choking you?" And the answer is, I don't think he wasn't choking me. That wasn't what was written. That wasn't what we're doing. He's just holding me so damn tight. You know, he's like, his fists are clenched around my clothing so tightly that I couldn't, I couldn't really move and breathe properly. And so
it seems like genuine terror. Also, from Matt's point of view, because you're watching and thinking, actually, this is probably the most vulnerable we've ever seen this character, Matt / Daredevil, in two seasons.
The other thing in that scene, which I'm not sure was present in the script, but is one of those things that's very hard to convey. It's easy to write down on a script, but it's very hard to convey, especially in a scene like that, was that Matt has one moment where he disengages and punches, gets one punch in.
Yep.
And the thinking behind it all is that's the biggest risk he takes in that scene. Because the one thing he can't do is he mustn't, in this moment of fear and aggression and pride and all those things, he mustn't reveal who he is.
Yeah.
This guy still doesn't know who he is.
Yeah.
So there is that at play as well, which is part of all that.
Absolutely, because you're waiting. Because obviously the way out of it is for him to snap into Daredevil mode, do an acrobatic somersault over Fisk.
Yeah, and recreate the end and of suddenly, season one.
Yeah, precisely.
Right, but he can't do that. Yeah, he can't do that. So there's a mixture, I think. There's a mixture of, one, he can't do that. But also I think that in this particular scene, Fisk has the upper hand.
Yeah.
He's caught him off guard. Mm. And I'm not even sure if Matt could, if he wanted to. I don't know if he could in that moment. Mm. He could backflip out of it. I think he's in a tight spot.
Absolutely. And he will be in a tighter spot in season three, I'm guessing, as well. I mean, just very, very quickly, what the future holds for you both. I mean, Elodie, you probably can't say anything about when Elektra might come back.
I just don't know.
Yeah.
They don't tell me anything.
she's lying. She knows it all. She's refusing to tell us.
I never lie.
Was that itself a lie?
Yeah.
not at all.
It's exactly what someone who would lie, who lied would say.
And Charlie, you've got Defenders coming up, I'm presuming, before season 3. Season 3 hasn't been announced yet. There's no talk about it, but
yeah. So as far as yeah. you know, my plan is Defenders.
And what are you looking for from Defenders?
I have no idea. I'm fascinated to see how the worlds combine. Mm-hmm. I've seen Jessica Jones. I've heard a lot about Luke Cage. I know about the casting of Iron Fist. I guess they're starting that imminently. So I'm interested to see how those worlds combined. I know that a lot of, because this second season, the second half of season 2 of Daredevil had a mythical element to it. Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, I think, looking ahead to the Iron Fist story. Otherwise, how do those 4 characters exist in the same world? Mm-hmm. I think the lesson, from a story point of view, the lesson that Matt has had to learn in the second season of Daredevil is that he needs help.
Yeah.
He can't do this alone. And he's been so adamant about him being a lone wolf, about him doing it by himself, not involving anyone else. Now he's presumably going to be teaming up. So I think that in order for him to get to the Defenders, we needed this second season. We needed to see him be broken individually so that he's willing to form a team.
Absolutely. And we'll find out what's in that hole, maybe. Finally.
Yeah, maybe.
What's in that big damn
Please
hole?
Tell me what's
damn
in that
hole.
Charlie, Elodie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Well, that was fascinating.
Thanks, Helen.
I had no idea he was British.
You know, he's not blind either.
What?
Yeah, I know. Amazing.
Also,
amazing.
Why is his name Charlie? What's that about? I thought it was Matt.
You know, this is how names work.
What?
What?
Okay, we don't have time to get into that. But what we are going to get into now is Daredevil Season 2. There's a lot of stuff to talk about, 13 episodes. Don't know how we're going to do it. So we're going to take, I think, major talking points. Also, we've had questions via email, we've had questions via Twitter, and questions via Facebook we're going to try and tackle as best we can. Bear in mind, of course, we're not Doug Petrie and Marco Ramirez, the showrunners. This is not definitive. This is just our opinions. I want to start off with the major talking point of the season. I think it's the thing that's on everybody's lips. Who is Steven Ryder's agent, and how does every other actor in the world get this guy representing him? Because this is amazing. Steven Ryder, in case you don't know, plays the DA's assistant, Blake Tower, in the show. And he's there on the credits, up front and center, almost every single episode. Certainly everyone he appears in, he's on there. So you get obviously Charlie Cox is on the main cast list, Elodie Young, Deborah Ann Wall, Eldon Henson, Scott Glenn when he appears, obviously John Bernthal as the Punisher. And then there's Steven Ryder as Blake Tower. And I got fascinated by this because I thought, who is this guy? He must come into the season at some point. He must have a huge arc. He must really play an integral role in this season. I swear to God, he has fewer lines in the show than Shopkeeper 1.
I'll be honest, Chris.
No, that's not fair.
When the opening titles come on, that's the point where I go make a cup of tea.
Really? I like the theme tune.
Yeah, it's a good theme. The whole bloodiness is cool.
Yeah.
But I think this is setting somebody up a little bit for the future because his role does get bigger. Come on, it does get bigger as the season goes on, as that thing happens to his boss.
We can talk about it. It's a spoiler special.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, his boss gets riddled with bullets.
Riddled with bullets. Bummer for her. But he's a more prominent character actually for Luke Cage and Iron Fist. So I think what they're doing is essentially setting him up for the future.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You come at it with your common sense.
I'm sorry.
And you come out with your real answers. I'm just saying, if I were Michelle Hurd, who plays D.A. Reyes, I'd be a little annoyed because I get way more lines. And way more to do and have more of an impact on this season.
Okay, sure.
Than Steven Ryder, who's perfectly good and I thought was perfectly serviceable in the role, and I look forward to seeing him in future shows.
Absolutely.
But I'm just saying. Right, so now we've got the big question out of the way.
That was the big question.
That just kept me awake at night, that one. What do we make of the season itself? I mean, let's talk about that first in sort of overall terms. Because I've seen quite a few people mixed in this one. A lot of people think that this is better than season 1. A lot of people have said it's very, very good. But equally, I know some people who were slightly underwhelmed. But I think it's a quality, solid piece of television with some caveats. But what did you make of it?
Yeah, I'd be somewhat in that camp, I think. I thought lots of the new elements, particularly the Punisher, Elektra, were really, really, really well done. I was utterly thrilled. I think I actually screamed aloud at the return of Wilson Fisk because I loved him. If anybody listened to our previous Daredevil spoiler, I loved him. In season 1, I thought he was just the best villain. So I was absolutely thrilled to see him again. I thought, for me, the problem maybe was that the storytelling kind of felt a little bit fragmented in the second half of the season, or maybe the last third, more accurately. And sometimes the central trio, oftentimes the central trio, I mean, they fell apart and they didn't spend a lot of time together. And so if you're looking for Karen and Foggy and Matt, then this is not the season for you.
Do you know what's interesting about what you just said? You said the central trio, and I immediately thought, Matt, Elektra, and Frank.
Exactly.
And that maybe says something about the very point you were trying to make, that I don't think of Foggy and Karen anymore as being part of the central trio.
And maybe that's intentional. Maybe that's very, very deliberate. Maybe moving on to those much bigger characters, much more complicated characters, actually kind of sets you up better for moving towards the Defenders. But it does feel like a change. And it feels like, I think, if anything, Matt Murdock was extremely shortchanged this season. And I know we've had a little bit of a conversation about this, Chris. Mm-hmm. But Matt Murdock, I think, did not have a great season. Daredevil maybe had a better one.
Okay. Expand on that.
Well, I thought Matt... I mean, did a lot of stuff wrong. I mean, it really, really screws up. And maybe that's interesting. It is interesting.
It's very interesting.
Because he really messes up his own life.
Yeah.
I mean, we're told, I think, in season one, if I remember correctly, that basically he had invested everything he had in the law firm, in Nelson and Murdoch. And as we open this season, Nelson and Murdoch are essentially on the verge of bankruptcy, and they drive straight into it as the season goes on.
Yeah.
So he's presumably lost everything. He doesn't seem to care at all. He doesn't seem to be focused on that even slightly. He loses his friend in the process, you know, cares, but not enough to do anything about it. He completely screws up with Karen, cares, but not enough to give up Elektra. And so he kind of genuinely loses everything that we were told was important to him in season one, apart from being Daredevil.
Which we'll get onto in a second. John, what do you think of that?
Well, yeah, I would say that's probably the thrust of the season, isn't it? I think that's what they're going for, is that this character is almost overtaken by his superhero identity.
And that's interesting, because I've argued in the past that the traditional model of the superheroes, right, is film one is the origin story. Film two, the superhero gives up being a superhero. In film three, the superhero goes bad. What we have here instead is, in film two, the superhero essentially giving up being a normal person. Which I guess is an interesting spin.
What we have here, and I think this is quite intriguing all the way through the show, is the presentation of Matt Murdock as an imperfect hero, first of all. He makes a lot of bad decisions. His decision to go to the prison to confront Wilson Fisk, and his decision to dangle a threat to Vanessa in front of Fisk is a terrible decision that will have huge repercussions, because I think it's very, very clear that Wilson Fisk is A, going to get out of prison, and B, discover that Matt Murdock and Daredevil are one and the same, and C, put the hammer down. I think that's going to happen. There's an interesting thread that runs throughout the season in that Matt Murdock becomes addicted to Daredevil. He becomes addicted to being Daredevil to the detriment of almost everything else in his life. And I think he begins to believe his own lie, which is that the city needs him and this is his city and this is my playground. And he hides behind that as an excuse. It's just a simple excuse to fob off Foggy and to fob off Karen, I think.
That's almost the first thing he says in the first episode. You see we open with that fantastic sort of chase fight through the streets, ending, of course, in a Catholic church. But then it's him the next morning talking to Foggy, and it's him saying exactly that, justifying himself exactly that way. If I take a night off, people die.
Which he does repeatedly throughout the season. If you know, and there are moments when he's at death's door, there are moments when he's exhausted. And I'm sitting there as a viewer who's very, very invested in this character now, just almost yelling at him, take some time off. Mm-hmm. Recuperate. Recover. It's fine. But he's so laden down by this idea of the Catholic guilt that haunts him, the idea that if he takes, if he takes one night off, if someone dies, then it's on him, and he's drowning in this guilt. But again, for me, I think that's just an excuse. I think it's all about the rush of being a hero. Mm. He likes the crunch of villains' bones as they are ground to powder under his fists. He likes that. He likes swinging from rooftops. And you could see why. It would be pretty addictive.
Do you think, we've talked about this a little before we started recording, Matt, the lawyer, is almost kind of unlikable this season. I mean, he makes some, as you said, some terrible decisions. He didn't show up to the opening statement of the Trial of the Century. And then when he does show up, he provokes Frank Castle into basically ruining the trial for them. So that side of his character is almost a bad guy. He really, really doesn't do anything that you want to root for. Whereas the Daredevil side is a kind of a hero. I mean, he steps up his game in terms of, battling villains and taking on bad guys. And
That's interesting about, Matt sort of screwing up as a lawyer. But he so wants to give up. There is, in the last episode, he expressly says to Elektra, let's just run away from all this. Let's just completely give it up. And you sense that he's not talking about giving up the Daredevil-ry, and she's not talking about giving up her, adrenaline fueled adventures. They're talking about giving up normality at that point, and I think it's quite telling. That's the point he comes to by the end of the season, and it will be interesting to see if anything has actually changed when we pick him up again next time.
So, okay, obviously this is a lot of stuff to talk about. We're going to be flitting around between episodes and major plot points. But the Matt, Electra, Karen situation, I hesitate to call it a love triangle because they're not really aware of each other. Karen's not really aware of Electra. There's that point where she comes into Matt's apartment and sees this beautiful Greek woman lying in his bed. And she kind of goes, oh, what are you doing? Doesn't stop to question who the old blind guy is, by the way. But it's not really that traditional thing, but it's clearly Matt's got to make a choice between Electra and Karen. Do you think that Matt's decision at the end on the rooftop to go with Electra, to turn his back on the city that he is sworn to protect, which is what he says, let's go away, paraphrasing, do you think that's a genuine decision? Do you think that he means it? Or do you think he knows that one or both of them is going to die? And in the aftermath of that, he does seem to choose Karen as a sort of fallback. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah, it's interesting you said that, because I was watching that scene thinking, maybe this is almost like a ploy. Like, maybe this is sort of a motivational speech to get her to fight with him one last time against Nobu. I wasn't 100% convinced that he would want to run away, just drop everything and run away.
I don't know if he meant it permanently, but it's got to be there, doesn't it? I mean, that line about I've never been north of 110th Street or whatever it was, that rang a little bit true, you know? So maybe he just means a holiday.
A holiday.
Yeah. Daredevil on holiday, come on.
Nip over to Brooklyn for the weekend.
So you think that he's not quite genuine and he's just basically...
I think it's a possibility. Okay. I think because partly this is because I found the Karen-Matt relationship more convincing than the Electra-Matt relationship. At least in modern day terms, I thought those flashbacks were really nicely done, and I believe that. But, you know, the way that she re-enters his life in kind of an annoying way, just breaks into his flat and then just, you know, blackmails him and interrupts his work. And, you know, I would not want to get back together with her after she...
But I loved a lot of the Electra-Matt stuff. I thought that Elliot Young was absolutely fantastic as this capricious, very, very temperamental character. And you can see why Matt's head would be turned by her.
Not only,
you know, obviously is she beautiful, but she's this dark, dangerous, exotic person that he knows he shouldn't get involved with, because he knows back from when they first met, when he had, you know, I love the flashbacks to, you know, young Matt and young Electra when they basically just parked Charlie Cox's hair in a slightly different way.
That's right.
And shaved the stubble off him. There you go, he's 21 now. But he knows that he shouldn't get involved with Electra, but at the same time, you can absolutely see why he would find it hard to turn his back and someone as compelling as that.
I liked the sort of idea that there's this superhero camaraderie, that they share something that the normal people don't understand. And it's something they explored in Jessica Jones as well. And there's that sort of notion that only they understand, you know, that they have this secret that the rest of the world can't fathom.
It's essential. I think it's been done best in Batman Returns, personally.
With Penguin and Max Schreck.
With Penguin and Max Schreck, yeah. They were the ones. Oh, and also, I guess, another way to look at it would be Batman and Catwoman.
Oh, yeah, those two, yeah. No, I see what you mean. That's sort of, you know, they both understand the unique thrills that they get from what they do. And in that way, poor Karen doesn't really stand a chance. Mm. And you knew, as their relationship developed over the first four episodes, that Electra was coming. And you knew that something bad was going to happen to Karen and Matt's relationship. And I liked where it was going, but no one in these things is allowed to be happy for more than 5 minutes.
No, so, it does seem to be the case.
So that was a real shame. By the way, because one of the things, we talked about this in the last Daredevil spoiler special, it's one of the things I love about the MCU, actually, is the authenticity of location. The fact that, you know, you actually could go on a Daredevil tour if you wanted to. If you went to the Big Apple, you could do this. So if you do want to go to the Indian restaurant where Karen and Matt go on their date, which has these incredible lights inside it, it's the Panna 2 Guardian Indian Restaurant in New York. So
I am so there. Those lights were amazing.
Yeah, that was a lovely scene, actually. I've been to Hell's Kitchen, not to that restaurant, but I was in New York last year.
Were you fighting crime?
I wasn't fighting crime, but I did eat a burger. In many ways, I am also like Daredevil, really.
Okay.
That's all I have to say. I've just been to Hell's Kitchen.
Okay. So where do you think Matt and Karen go from here? Matt has now revealed his secret identity to the world's greatest journalist.
what was the job application process for that? I mean, did she...
Also, she gets a job in journalism. That in itself is unconvincing nowadays. Come on.
That editor does not know that she can string a sentence together. She might be dyslexic.
And she proves quite stunningly in the final few moments of the final episode that she can string a sentence together. And put yourself in Ellison's shoes. He's been asking Karen Page to write 2,000 words on something, anything, for what seems like weeks. And she's in Ben Urich's office, poor old dead Ben Urich, whose office, maybe this felt unrealistic to me as well, hasn't been touched.
Yeah.
Well, he was quite important, obviously, to the Not Daily Bugle. But, you know, you would think time enough had passed for someone else to maybe be in that office. So Karen walks into the office and goes, can you write? Well, I don't know. Have you any qualifications? Not really. Okay, well, I need 2,000 words by Sunday. And she takes ages to write them. And then when it happens, it's just the most ridiculous Hallmark greeting card nonsense. Anyway.
Well, this is a wider conversation about unconvincing pieces of great writing in cinema and TV.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, when people read out great writing in cinema and TV, it sounds terrible.
What is it to be a hero? you look at that and you go, I need to be writing. Okay. Karen?
maybe there's just something about being in one of these shows or one of these films. Because, you know, think of every example you've ever heard of Lois Lane's writing. It just never rings true, does it?
Well, people say people don't buy papers anymore, and that is why. This is the thing. If you were Karen Page, and I know we're getting off the subject.
If you were Karen Page
and you had been intimately involved with The Punisher, I mean, intimately involved.
God.
I mean, you've been to his house and you'd seen all sorts of stuff. And you start your story on that with, what is it to be a hero? No, you want, you know, hi, I'm, you know, I was involved with, you know, this is not great writing. This is not my process. This is not how I work. You know, hello, I was involved with the Punisher and the bad man came and then the good man came and saved me. That's what you would write. You know, you'd write something gritty and like, you know, like a John Grisham thriller.
Oh, or anyway. A Lee Child thriller.
Oh, yeah. Paige said nothing. Anyway.
Maybe the first episode of season 3 is the editor saying, Karen, just come into my office, would you? Just got a few notes.
This is rubbish! Anyway, Karen and Matt, where do they go next? Why has Matt revealed himself as steady? Why has he shown his helmet to Karen?
Stop it.
That's what it is, Helen. You can't get around it.
I don't think it is. It's more of a cowl, isn't it? It's usually called a cowl.
He shows his cowl to...
It doesn't sound any better, does it?
Where do they go next? Where can they possibly go next? Great.
We don't really know what his... state is at that point in terms of Elektra, in terms of you know, and there could be one of those horrendous kind of New York dating discussions you hear about going, but we weren't even exclusive, you know, we hadn't even had that conversation, you know,
they'd only kissed.
Can't possibly have been exclusive. Would she be allowed to feel betrayed or hurt? Mm-hmm. Who knows?
I don't know. I liked that they left it sort of ambiguous on her reaction. You know, she didn't really give one way or another. I really hope they don't do the whole Foggy thing where we just have episode after episode of, you know, stroppy arguing. Just like, stop being such a superhero. You're so bloody good at fighting crime and it's getting on my nerves. You know, I'm paraphrasing.
I was looking at the IMDb quotes page and none of that appeared.
But do you know what I mean? That sort of, I think they've expended a lot of time in Foggy just moralizing about his vigilantism.
I think they have to do something different because I think you're right. And I also think Karen wouldn't react the same way because she has much warmer, fuzzier feelings towards Daredevil.
Exactly.
She's and indeed
herself been rescued
Matt.
By Daredevil.
Exactly.
On a couple of occasions.
So I think she'd probably be like, oh, figures. Mm. And then just have to kind of figure out the mechanics of it and everything else.
I'm intrigued to see where that relationship goes. I'm intrigued to see what happens if and when Elektra returns, because obviously her body has been taken seemingly by La Hand and put into that giant oven. Mm. Presumably she's going to be turned into a giant Bakewell tart. which would be awesome. The Daredevil MasterChef crossover I've been hoping for is finally going to happen. Greg Wallace and John Turode cameoing, that's a difficult word to say, cameoing in season three.
Yeah, she's kind of wrapped in red sashes in that.
No, you want to be wrapped in filo pastry. You want to have
well, you would be, yeah, but yeah. No, not filo, for a bakewell.
For
come
a bakewell.
On, come on, Chris.
Come on.
Well, short crust, Chris. Come
teach
on.
Me.
Thanks, Dr. Strange. Are you calling me the ancient one? Anyway. No, it's sort of closer to her traditional costume, I guess.
Okay.
I thought it was a little nod there on purpose.
Yes, absolutely. I thought Elodie Young was fantastic. I love the way she called Matthew. I'm doing it myself. She called Matt Murdock Matthew all the way through the series. You know, just lovely little touch.
Yeah. Hey, you know who we haven't talked about yet?
Lots of people.
I mean, but really?
You want to talk about Blake Tower again?
No.
Okay.
Who? The Punisher.
Was he in it?
He was there.
Well, I would like to say, because it does feel like a bit of a season of two halves, in sort of the first half is Punisher heavy and the second half is Elektra and the Hand heavy.
Yes.
And the first half I absolutely adored. I thought the first three episodes in particular, I watched them back to back and it felt like one awesome Marvel movie.
Yeah.
And Punisher's introduction, I thought, was handled really well. It's made him very cool. I'm not really familiar with his character. I've not seen the Punisher films. I'm aware of who he is, but
you're not missing a lot.
Yeah, this is what I've heard. But he's given a lot of bluster and weight to his introduction. It feels very big and important.
He's played almost like a horror movie villain at first, which I thought was fantastic. He's the bogeyman, you know, which I thought was absolutely brilliantly done.
I'm very, very pleased with the way they introduced Frank Castle. I'm a huge Punisher fan. I adore that character. Garth Ennis's run on the comics across both the traditional comics and the Max run, I think, is superlative. Even before that, I was a big Punisher fan. But yeah, it's what I was hoping that they wouldn't do, and I'm glad they didn't do it, was a replication of the arcs of Wilson Fisk and Kilgrave in Daredevil Season 1 and Jessica Jones, where the villain is alluded to and you don't really see them for a very long, long time. And obviously they're given a lot of psychological depth, but you have to wait a long, long time for it. You have to wait a long, long time to find out that Wilson Fisk killed his dad. You got to wait a long, long time to find out what happened to Kilgrave with his parents and the experiments and all that sort of stuff. And right from episode 1, although you don't really, really see Frank that much, it's Punisher right up front. And the arc plays out very, very nicely. I liked the confrontation between Daredevil and Frank on the rooftop, which is very, very Garth Ennis-y in episode 3.
It's basically taken from The Choice, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, I liked that relationship a lot. So much so I was slightly frustrated when we didn't get a lot of Daredevil or even Matt Frank action or dialogue or even them being in the same room together for most of the rest of the show after that, which is a bit of a shame because, again, that conversation in the graveyard, again, a real graveyard in Brooklyn, it was at the end of episode 4, was very, very good indeed. And I thought, for me, I think episode 4 is my favourite. The episode where Tony Curran comes in as the Irish gang boss, Finn, for one blistering cameo.
Yeah, they set him up really nicely because you think, oh, this is our big bad then for a while. This is the guy we've got to keep an eye on. And nope.
Yeah, and then he gets dispatched summarily with a shotgun blast to the face, which they show, which is very interesting and reminiscent of, you know, I say the Punisher films aren't great, but Lexi Alexander's Punisher Warzone is extraordinarily violent and very, very blackly comic. So check that one out. Mm. And there's a shotgun blast to the face in that one that this was reminiscent of. But yeah, also Tony Curran, quick digression, Tony Curran becomes one of the few people to play two roles in the MCU. Mm. Can you tell me his first role? I will give you 30 seconds on the clock.
I can see his face, but I can't remember it now. Sorry.
He plays Odin's dad, Bor, at the beginning of Thor: The Dark World.
He's under
heavy makeup, and he's not credited, in fairness. So yeah, so that's intriguing. And yeah, and then he's dispatched, Frank is injured, and he gets taken into custody, thus allowing Brett Mahoney, again, wonderful to see that character grow over Daredevil Season 1, Jessica Jones, and now Daredevil Season 2, hopefully Luke Cage and Iron Fist as well. But then it allows him, as the only cop in New York, to get a promotion, which then would allow him to show up at all the crime scenes, which is good.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, he's his personal helicopter getting him to every crime scene in New York. It must be very handy.
It's all in Hell's Kitchen. It's fine.
Yeah, it's, fine. It's all good. But yeah, more about The Punisher, I guess. A lot of people think that John Bernthal was the absolute standout of this season. I'm actually glad that Matt Murdock and Daredevil weren't sidelined. It's still very much Daredevil's show. But I think that means when you got bits of Frank, and he absolutely brings with that sort of laser-focused intensity. It was wonderful to watch.
Yeah, he's kind of my favourite genre of character on TV, yeah. Which tends to be extremely grumpy men who hide a heart of gold under a lot of army surplus. So
who else is in that?
Dean from Supernatural.
Oh, no.
Luke from Gilmore Girls. He's a little bit less violent than the other two, but, you know, if it's... Anyway.
Ross from Friends.
But I just thought he was just a fascinating character because he did have something going on beneath the violence, but he was still just violent. Like, he wasn't particularly conflicted in that sense. He was driven, he was motivated, but he wasn't then self-doubting and endlessly kind of dithering. Quite the opposite, in fact, which is kind of nice because I think Daredevil is supposed to dither in a sense. That's the whole Catholic guilt thing coming out again. Mm-hmm. He's supposed to be conflicted. He's supposed to be worried. And he is supposed to be torn between being Matt Murdock and being Daredevil, you know, in the same way that Spider-Man is persistently torn between his two halves and still always trying to do justice to both. I think Daredevil has a very, very similar kind of split in a way that, you know, not every superhero does. You know, the X-Men, for example, you know, they don't have that. So I think there is a certain kind of character that has to deal with real life problems as well as superhero problems on a completely different scale. And that presents a nice contrast to someone like the Punisher who just does it.
Yeah, he just is.
Yeah.
He absolutely is, and he exists just to kill bad guys. His arc seems to finish. It seems to come to a natural conclusion. You have the investigation into the blacksmith, who may or may not have been responsible for the deaths of his wife and kids. What do we make of that arc, ultimately, the way it concluded? And do you think there was a point where Frank could have walked away and just become Frank Castle again, but he makes a conscious decision to carry on and become the Punisher?
I'm not sure he ever could have. I think he could have told himself he had that way out, but I'm not sure he ever really did, actually. So it made sense to me. As soon as I saw that vest hanging up, you could actually see the skull shape on the vest even before he put the white sort of paint on, which I thought was a nice little touch. In fact, I was surprised they then bothered to put the paint on it because I thought that was subtle enough that you kind of got it. But
yeah. I was slightly surprised they didn't do a proper hero shot of this very, very dark anti-hero on the roof as he, you know, takes out a couple of ninja with his big scope.
Yeah, it did sort of fizzle out, his whole storyline towards the end, which was a real shame because it was built up so heavily and with such purpose in the early episodes that, yeah, it did feel slightly like a squandered opportunity.
It's a tricky one, though, because The Punisher is basically quite one note. And it's amazing that John Bernthal brought such depth and such raw pain to this character. And even though I love the character and read the comics for a long, long time, basically, he's like a shark. He eats, he sleeps, he kills bad guys. And that's it. That's all he does. And the season presented, first of all, Matt as a moral counterpoint to him. And then Karen, who, of course, we, the viewer, know killed Wesley at the end of season one.
Yeah.
No one else knows that. So she knows what it's like to take a life and then to try and walk the righteous path after that. And so then it presents her as a moral counterpoint. It presents her as the angel on his shoulder saying, don't kill, don't kill. You don't have to kill. You don't have to kill those two guys in the diner, which he does with incredibly violent ways. You don't have to kill Clancy Brown as Major MacGuffin. You don't, you know, but he does, because ultimately that's all he does. If he relents in any way, shape or form, if he goes, okay, you're right, I will just shoot to wound, I will be the Terminator from Terminator 2, I will just kneecap people, I'll be fine. Then the character goes away, essentially. So he's never going to change. Mm. And so the dramatic possibilities of putting him in with other people soon become quite limited, which is why I think they haven't still announced a Punisher series, as much as we would love to see more John Bernthal in this universe, and I would be amazed if he didn't show up at some point in The Defenders or even Iron Fist or Luke Cage. You know, you do wonder, would a series be enough? Could that character hold your attention for a whole series? The same way that I think Marvel know that the Hulk now wouldn't hold a movie.
Yeah, maybe, I guess. I think it's interesting, maybe it's interesting when you contrast him with other characters in the same way that you have that moral dilemma between him and Daredevil on the rooftop in episode 3, New York's Finest. I think that's maybe the crux of the matter. You need someone to present that other point of view, perhaps. And it's a weird one. I mean, I've talked endlessly, I'm sure, about my problems with Batman's one rule. And similarly, Daredevil's one rule, you cannot be sure if you punch someone the way these guys punch, if you knock someone down the things these guys knock people down from, if you suspend people by a limb, if you do whatever these things are. There's one point in that staircase fight in, what was it, episode 3?
Episode 3, yeah.
Where Daredevil repeatedly slams someone in a door. Now, I don't think it's their head he's slamming in a Wilson Fisk fashion, but yeah, he's definitely repeatedly slamming what looks like quite a heavy door on a person.
Yeah.
You can't be sure that that person won't die. And legally, that's not manslaughter. That is full-on murder.
As a lawyer. As a fully qualified lawyer.
Yeah, it's maybe a second degree murder rather than first degree, but actually I think it would probably be first degree. So
No jury in the country would convict Matt Murdock.
But they would, though, wouldn't they? Well, they'd have to catch him. That would be the problem. But I'm saying that any time you hear one of these heroes having this one rule, it's always very suspect because they can't be sure that death won't follow what they do. So maybe the rule is no murder as they see it, as in no intentional killing. But even that's pretty fuzzy. So what I'm saying is there shouldn't be that much space between the Punisher and Daredevil, actually. Mm. Legally, there certainly wouldn't be. But I guess morally, they still see that distinction between them. And Matt would still argue morally, and he should know better because he's a lawyer, that he is more restrained.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting the way that Matt's very black and white worldview is gradually taken over by shades of grey, or let's be honest, splotches of red as the season progresses, to the point where, and Charlie Cox rejected this in fairness in the interview, that when I suggested that he was more than happy that the Punisher and Elektra were killing left, right and centre on the roof around him at the very end of the season. And that's fair enough, you know, maybe he's not thrilled that Frank Castle's taking out people, but certainly he's not protesting anymore. He's on that roof with Elektra fighting for his life. He throws Nobu off the roof. Mm. Now, I've rewatched that scene a couple of times, and you could read it a couple of different ways. One is that the way I see the scene, he doesn't intend for the Billy Club chain to snap and for Nobu to fall to what you would imagine would be his death. That's one reading. Uh-huh. Another reading, of course, is he knows that Nobu is essentially unkillable. So throwing him off the roof isn't going to do anything, and he doesn't necessarily know that Stick is down there waiting with the sword to chop his head off.
True.
But if you look at it as the ultimate degradation of Matt's moral code, the third reading, of course, is that he does intend to throw Nobu off the roof.
Because he just killed Elektra.
Yeah, because he just killed Elektra. So therefore, Matt does break his one rule at the end of the at the end of the episode. And how much does he know the Stick then kills him? I mean, so I'm just intrigued to know at the end of the season where Matt stands. Does he feel that he has taken a human life, knowingly taken a human life for the first time? And what does that mean for that character?
Mm. Yeah, I'm not sure. I watched it again last night as well, and I was just not clear on the sequence of events for that point. That episode I find slightly muddled. I didn't always feel completely clear on what everyone was doing and why. Why take Elektra's body and resurrect her? Is that the Black Sky thing? I mean, what's that about?
Yeah, this feels, as much as I really enjoyed this season, I thought the last few episodes were slightly blighted by what I thought to be muddy storytelling. Motivations seemed to shift almost from scene to scene, which was annoying.
And the whole, like, in the middle there, we had that weird, almost, I thought it was going to turn into a vampire plague at one point. You had all those people hooked up and giving blood to the big coffin, right? And then they seemed to be possessed or somehow infected in turn, and certainly operating under someone else's control to do bad things. That didn't seem to be explained in any way. Is that going to hook up to something in Iron Fist? Is it going to hook up to something in Luke Cage? Like, that was bizarre.
I think the more mystical elements will probably be explored in Iron Fist. Luke Cage seems like it's more of going to be a brawling show. Iron Fist, I think, will fill in the blanks. Which, to be fair, the show has been hinting at for a long, long time. It's, you know, certainly suggested that Madame Gao, who appears for one very, very brief scene in this, is a lot older than she lets on.
Yeah, and she says she's from much further away than China.
Which indicates, of course, that she may not even be of this planet. Indeed. And then you have Nobu coming back from certain death. Whether he can grow another head or not is another thing. But, and of course, the young kid that Stick killed in the first season was meant to be Black Sky. They say that was Black Sky. Mm-hmm. And so there's that mystical element already to the show, which I think is perfectly fine in a show about a blind guy who can use his super senses to kick the living crap out of people. But it did seem to me to be the last half of the season was built in shifting sands. I thought it was a very interesting move not to have an overarching villain. six or seven episodes in, I turned to my wife, we were watching it together, and I went, this is really interesting, because you know, you think Frank's going to be the bad guy, but it wants to have a cake, it's cake and eat it with Frank, so he's not really the bad guy. Then Electra comes in, she's got shady motivations, but she's not really the bad person, because again, it wants to have his cake and eat it with her too.
Yeah.
Then you kind of turn to my wife and say, there's no bad guy. Who's the bad guy?
And then
in
they
this?
Bring in Fisk, but Fisk. He isn't the bad guy.
No, he's not the bad guy. And then gradually they go, oh, it's the hand. It's the hand. And they bring Nobu in as the ostensible face of that company or shadowy organization, whatever you want to call it. But there's still no real bad guy. There's this entity, there's this thing, this amorphous blob called the hand that, you know.
And who is meant to have been in the coffin thing, resurrection chamber, when Nobu was guarding it? We didn't see that, right? Am I forgetting?
Not to my knowledge, no. All the blood was going
to? All the blood was going in. There was presumably somebody in there. It wasn't Nobu at that point. He's out doing things.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Unless maybe. He's going in every night and having a rest.
Maybe we're reading it wrong. Yeah, maybe who knows? Maybe it'll be revealed later on. But I thought it was a really refreshing decision, but it didn't quite pay off for me in terms of they didn't really seem to know who the ultimate enemy was going to be.
Yeah, I think by around episode 7 or 8, it started to lose a bit of focus. I think, like you say, the lack of an overarching villain is an interesting sort of move, but you don't have that central force, that sort of unifying direction. I think Nobu really isn't that interesting a character, really. Mm. He's not someone that you really understood motivations. He's not someone that you really felt Matt's had, you know, an interesting sort of conflict with, like you did with Fisk.
And they had an amazing fight.
Oh, no, amazing. But that's the thing. And also, I felt the fight scenes in general, I mean, the fighting throughout this series was very strong, amazingly well choreographed. But I thought towards the end, it started to feel a bit repetitive. It felt a bit like Whack a Ninja. You know, there was just every fight scene was just literally faceless villains. How many ninjas are there in New York? What, really? Like, there's like an unendless tap of ninjas.
How would you know? You're not going to see them, are you?
John, don't look behind you now.
They're not even supposed to have swords. They're like original ninjas are spies. You know this. It's a westernized version of ninjas.
But I liked what the show did with the ninja, which is actually the plural ninja, is ninja. I liked what the show did with him, and I liked the fact that they forced Matt to evolve and push his powers in a different direction, that he couldn't hear the guys at that giant hole, which I'm sure we will be told what that hole is at some point. It was frustrating, but this is one of the pitfalls.
Do you know what I mean?
But, you know, he couldn't hear the guys coming, and he had to focus on
their weapons
and their breathing, because they have to breathe at some point. Yeah. Even ninja have to breathe.
Yeah, but he couldn't hear the heartbeat. That was weird. Because
ninja can slow their heartbeats down. Do you know this, Helen?
Yeah, but that doesn't make any sense if you're moving, Chris.
No. They can slow their heartbeat down. It's written in the ninja textbook. I've got it here. Being a ninja for dummies.
Well,
chapter 3. I think it's chapter 3.
You are joking, but this sort of speaks to a point about how it using things like ninjas and mystical beings and, you know, this sort of Eastern mythology, suddenly it almost leads to lazy storytelling, because you can just sort of explain it away. It's like, they're ninjas. they're ninjas. They can stop their heartbeat. But, like, really, how can they? If you really stop to think about it, how did that happen? Because the first season was so grounded in reality, and I felt like this kind of got away from it a little bit. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, until there were.
Well,
like
maybe there will be. Honestly, I genuinely thought when you got to the bottom of the giant pit and found the people hooked up with blood going into what looked like a coffin, I honestly thought, are we in vampire territory here? I'm pretty sure I saw that scene in one of the Underworld movies, and almost that would have made more sense to me and would have been a bit more interesting than what we got in some ways.
I'm intrigued to see where it goes. I'm intrigued to see where that hole goes. I hope they know where it goes. I suspect they don't at this point in time. Let's talk about the return of Wilson Fisk. The show's bad guy, not this season's bad guy, but the show's bad guy. Just amazing when he shows up in the prison. Frank Castle goes to see him at the end of episode 7, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's episode 7. Amazing stuff. Vincent D'Onofrio.
I had to sort of remind myself that it was a television and, you know, I didn't have to be scared, because he is terrifying. That scene where he's slamming Matt into the table is just, it's so powerful, and it really just reminds you how big a villain this guy is in every sense. I mean, he's extraordinary. I thought his reintroduction was a complete surprise.
Yes.
I did not see it coming at all. And when it happened, I was just so thrilled and so it electrified the show. It really sort of lit a spark in it, I thought.
Yeah, his scenes in the last few were the best ones. I loved him sort of just taking control of the prison. I thought, well, yes, that's obviously how he'd do it. That makes sense. Mm. I love the confrontation between Fisk and Frank because you felt for the first time a little bit worried for Frank Castle, actually, which I hadn't before. Mm-hmm. I thought, this is a guy that he cannot necessarily deal with.
I think if it came down to it hand-to-hand, Frank would hand Fisk his ass. But it's interesting your reading of that, because obviously it's a very interesting thing. I was intrigued that Frank Castle would throw his lot in with Fisk, even if it was for the ultimate.
Yeah.
That was an interesting wrinkle for the character.
I wonder just how much he knows about Fisk. Maybe he didn't pay that much attention.
Yeah.
It's possible.
It led to that great corridor scene.
It led to that great double cross and that incredibly bloody corridor scene. I think it was I think it actually makes sense in terms of how prison systems work, but it also works beautifully that he was in white for that scene and briefly, and then he was in red, which was weird. But that was an absolutely incredible fight scene, even by the standards of corridor fight scenes in this show, which is a pretty high standard. I loved that little dynamic. I loved seeing the two of them together, and I just loved Wilson Fisk. I just think he's, I raved about it last season, but I just think he's one of the best TV villains in years. I think he's an absolutely fantastic, fantastic character and just brilliantly played by D'Onofrio.
Oh yeah, so good. That scene, the scene with Matt is extraordinary because, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but in the previous moments that we've seen him in season two, he's very calm. Even taking over the prison, he's very calm and he does it in a very nice and underhanded fashion. And then suddenly you just see the raging anger monster that lives inside him. And you talked about being worried for Frank. Even in that moment, you're going, well, this show is called Daredevil. There's four episodes to go. It's unlikely he's going to rip off Matt's head and piss down his neck. But I'm not ruling it out at this point either. I talked about it with Charlie Cox on the interview. So apologies if I'm repeating myself a little bit here. But you worry in that moment that Matt's going to give himself away as well. Because you're thinking, the only way he can possibly get out of this is to go, haha, I am Daredevil, and he will leap over, and suddenly he's like, why is the blind guy leaping over me and kicking me in the backside? What's happening? Now, hang on, he's Daredevil. And now he knows, and that guy knows, and this guy knows. But he can't, he has to stay there. But as Charlie Cox said, he doesn't think that he could actually extricate himself from Fisk's grip anyway.
Yeah.
It's a terrifying scene. And I cannot wait to see those two guys go head-to-head next season, if there is to be a next season.
Indeed.
And you'd imagine there will be. It'd be crazy. But more Wilson Fisk. Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. Black Sky is what I wanted to talk about. Because you talked about the fact that they didn't really seem to know where they were going. And in terms of some of the character allegiances, there's an episode where there's a run of an episode and a half, I think, where Stick saves Elektra's life and then tries to have her killed. And then she tries to go and kill Stick. And then she decides she's not going to kill Stick. And it all gets a bit muddied. And then there's a revelation that Elektra is Black Sky. Now, I don't know that they know what Black Sky is.
No.
But by that, I mean the characters in the show don't clearly know what it is, but I do wonder if the showrunners know what it is. I don't know. It just feels to me that Elektra is told she's Black Sky. Nothing seems to change. She's still herself. She's still Elektra. Why does she tell the hand to back off? Why does she just go, like, I am Black Sky. Leave me alone. Go away. I'm just going to go over to the Bahamas with my good friend here, Mr. Matthew Murdoch. Why does she do that? But it doesn't seem to really... Like everyone seems to go, oh my God, Elektra's Black Sky. Yeah. Elektra's Black Sky. And then it's like, what's Black Sky?
So again, it speaks to this using sort of mystical language and mystical terms, leading into sort of very nebulous concepts that aren't really explained. And it feels occasionally like unfocused or unfinished storytelling, like the writing could be a bit sharper.
Yeah, I
understand the need for a bit of smoke and mirrors, but you're right, that just didn't feel finished. It didn't quite feel complete.
There was a, I think there's a hint in the comics that the hand worships something called the Beast. Okay. And it's almost like this is the equivalent of that. But it isn't really, at least in my memory of the comics I've read, explained particularly who the Beast is in the comics. So there's no way of drawing, a complete sort of parallel. But
it's played by Kelsey Grammer, I think.
No, you're thinking of Nicholas Holt. But yeah, it's not clear, I'll be honest.
Yeah, it's interesting. And maybe we're wrong. Maybe right from the beginning, Maybe Drew Goddard, maybe then Stephen E. DeKnight when he took over, and then Pedrian Ramirez. Maybe they absolutely know what Black Sky is, and we won't find out until the Defenders, because I'm sure that Elektra will show up in the Defenders. I'm sure there's going to be something there, some sort of threat. It'll all come together. We'll find out what's in that bloody hole. I hope it's just an Amazon warehouse. It's just a bunch of kettles. That'd be amazing.
Maybe but, they just don't have a toilet in that warehouse. That's just where they chuck their, you know, human waste.
Mm. Maybe. Oh, God. I think Matt would know. I think he'd be like, Matt, are you okay? He's passed out because of the methane. He's just, oh, it's so bad. I think he would know. But, you know, this is not to say that we're ragging on the season. I just think, like, the first season, it didn't stick the landing for me, and which is a bit of a shame. Having said that, I think there was a lot of great stuff going on this year. I think a lot of great moments of TV, some very, very good episodes. I loved Elektra and Frank. Elektra and Frank? There's a... Get the fan fiction going. I love the scene where they infiltrated the party and they're trying to get out but pretending to be drunk. And yeah, that was very, very good stuff. And I just like that relationship in full brutality, the violence. And there's a lot of really, really good stuff. And the performances across the board are fantastic. I think Charlie Cox is great. And I think that the big boys over at Marvel Studios are missing a trick, frankly, if they don't find a way to get him into the MCU somehow.
Mm. Yeah, there doesn't seem to be much interest in tying the two universes much more closely together, which I think is a bit of a shame.
I mean, obviously there are lots of references. I mean, there's still references to, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure I heard the word Sokovia at one point. I think I heard the word Sokovia at one point. But if you look at, you know, the Ellison's Wall in the Not Daily Bugle, and you see references to Cybertech, which is a Deathlok reference in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and there's obviously, you know, references to the incident of the Avengers. So there are signs that they're beginning to knit all the aspects of the MCU together, the films and the much less violent Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Agent Carter over in ABC, and then the Netflix stuff as well. Obviously, you have Jerry Hogarth turning up at the very last episode, offering a Foggy a job, which is interesting. And it does make me wonder where we're going to see these characters next. Are we going to see Foggy next in The Defenders? Are we going to see Foggy next perhaps in Jessica Jones season 2? This is interesting. Where can it possibly go? And Foggy, who I think is a fantastic character, really well played, and gets a lot of nice heroic moments throughout the show. I think his evolution might be one to watch.
I would love to see him with Jessica Jones, actually. I think they'd be a hilarious pair. Fingers crossed.
Okay, he so clearly loves Karen as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's so clearly in love with Karen.
Massively smitten. Couldn't be more smitten.
I mean, just where's that going to go? As a frumpy guy myself, I'm rooting for Foggy. I want Foggy to get Karen. I want them to get together. I want, you know, Karen to realize that Matt is a busted flush. Do not go down that route, Karen. What are you doing? This guy breaks hearts. What are you doing? Go with Foggy. Safe, dependable.
Let the record show Chris just gestured weirdly at himself.
What I'm really saying is, Karen, choose me. That's basically what I'm saying.
Karen could have a totally different career by next season. She's probably, you know, a brain surgeon. I think season 4.
Once Ellison reads that, she's gone. She is out of there. Okay, let's go through some Twitter questions, Facebook questions, and email questions. Shane Dobbin says, "Dear residents of Hell's Kitchen, clearly you've been to the kitchen at Endeavour House. My God, I know every bacteria known to man has been. Do you feel this season missed a trick to not end with a more definitive link to Jessica Jones or Luke Cage, or do you feel the Foggy Harper scene was more than enough?"
I would have liked to have seen a little bit more knitting, I guess, of the shows.
More knitting?
More knitting.
This is just your general knitting.
Well, I can't knit, but...
You crochet?
Yeah.
Crochet.
I crochet. Yeah.
It's like knitting, isn't it?
Yeah, I crochet very badly, in my defence. But anyway, yeah, just a little bit more crossover between the shows now as we go forward. And especially, I mean, even if you're worried about giving something away next season, just in case the season that hasn't been shot yet slightly changes and things end up not aligning, you could certainly refer back a lot more than I think they do. So I'd like to see a bit more crossover that way, yes.
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't know contractually where they stand with Jessica Jones. Can she show up for a shot in this, or do they really want to wait for the... I think they want to wait for the Defenders before they get them all on. And then maybe season 3 of Daredevil, season 2 of Jessica Jones.
But you could do some smart things like have them listening to the talk show. Do you know what I mean? You could... I feel like there's a little bit more they can do without having the heroes necessarily made up. I think you could still have a bit more crossover among the supporting cast.
Yeah. Anyway. Rocks On, of course, is something that
it is, yeah.
Goes across all the shows and the films as well, which is cool. Okay. Hello there, Pod. This is Logan J. Nicholson. In episode 9, Karen logs onto Ben's computer. My question is, did she know his password or was a new logon made for her? Also, did you feel the ending to be sort of flat? I enjoyed the show a lot, but felt the ending to be rushed. I think we've covered that. Yeah. But the first part, yes. Karen, is this her secret power?
No, she knew his password, probably.
His password was password 123.
Okay.
Spoiler.
I've got a question.
Okay.
This is from Twitter. This is at Connor Walshy, who says, who is the dream casting for Bullseye? If there is a season Jim three, Bowen. It's a good Jim Bowen.
Jim Bowen.
Colin Farrell.
Jim Bowen again.
Of Bullseye.
Okay.
Took Come me a on, John. While. Don't make me explain everything, honestly.
Literally, the cogs in my head.
I'm taking you down, Bullseye. Ooh, Super Smashing Great. Let's take a look at what you could have won. That'd be amazing. It's a speedboat. The final battle could take place in a speedboat.
Anyway, do we have a serious answer?
Oh, sorry, that was my serious answer. I don't know. Okay, who do you think?
I would genuinely bring back Colin Farrell if I could. I absolutely loved his Bullseye.
He was the best thing, I think, about the 2003
Also,
film.
We don't have enough Irish superheroes. Since, or supervillains. So I will accept either, I'm not fussy. But since X-Men First Class stole Banshee and made him American, like, we don't have that many, you know?
To be in fairness, though, Helen, Banshee in the comics is written like a terrible parody of Irish people.
At least it was acknowledgement that we existed, Chris.
Ah, what about you there, with Charlie X? Jeez, begara, to be sure.
Whereas Colin Farrell, if you remember, played darts while sinking a pint of Guinness.
He certainly did.
So he wasn't a stereotype.
He wasn't a stereotype, no. He was very, very good. And you know who was? I know that Bullseye isn't Irish in the comics, but perhaps the fact that there's a new Irish crime fraternity in here.
Hey.
Perhaps Bullseye could be seeking revenge for the death of Tony Curran. Or at least the shooting off the face of Tony Curran, because he may be alive. You never know. Nick in Orlando, Florida says, how much of a missed opportunity would it be for these Netflix MCU characters to not pop up in Infinity War? I think they will.
I would like to see a little bit of that, actually. Yeah. I don't know. So I talked to the Captain America writers a couple of months ago when they just finished the first draft of Infinity Wars and handed it in. They've probably done 16 more drafts since. Hi, guys. And they certainly, I asked them to describe their office. Like, is it like one of those crazy person rooms with the string and all the things on the wall and the string leading?
Like a serial killer's lair.
Like a serial killer's lair.
I've never been to one, obviously.
Sure. And they said basically it is, but we have all the toys on a table in the middle. So they have like a Thor hammer and cap shield so they can get inspired by those. So they didn't specifically mention any of the Defenders, though. So that's my slight concern.
We have a billy club so we can pretend to be Matt Murdock, and a bottle of whiskey so we pretend to be Jessica Jones.
Basically.
Yeah. I think Lee's characters will play in. I mean, Infinity War is going to be so huge across the two films, even if it's just 30 seconds of screen time. Even if Daredevil just pops up, looks at the camera, smiles and waves, and says, bangly bang, I'll be quite happy.
Here's another question, though. Do you think that we might see some of them in Spider-Man Homecoming?
That's an interesting point. So Spider-Man and Daredevil mix quite a lot in the
they
comics,
mix quite
right?
a lot. They share a city.
Yeah.
We have been told that MCU characters will appear in Spider-Man, not which ones. But that would make a certain amount of sense. They're on a similar sort of a power scale. Spider-Man may be a little bit, you know, tougher, but not vastly so.
Also, frankly, I mean, let's be honest here. This is also about who Marvel can tell you are going to be in this movie. You know what I mean? They can't really turn around to Chris Evans or Robert Downey Jr. Although, you know, happy to be proved wrong. Happy to be proved wrong. But they can't really turn on Robert Downey Jr. and go, right, contractually, you now will be in Spider-Man Homecoming. They can't do that. But they can say to Charlie Cox, right, now you're in Spider-Man Homecoming.
Probably,
yeah. Or they can turn out to Jeremy Renner and go, right, you signed a 7-picture deal. One of those pictures is going to be Spider-Man Homecoming. That's kind of how they might be able to work on that one.
Anyway.
We shall see. Okay, so there is a Twitter question. Someone's asked, what was the point of the huge hole in the ground? I don't really know. Ozone John says, didn't understand Fisk's connection to the Punisher. He wanted him back in the streets to defeat the competition, but what did he then do?
Well, we don't know yet. Maybe. But I mean, it did help. You know, Fisk going away left a power vacuum. All these people popped up to fill the vacuum. The Punisher killed them all. That's got to be in Fisk's interest.
Yes. He used him as his own personal hitman, almost in a way. This comes from at Martha Wayne.
Oh, God.
Do you think...
Why did you say that name?
Oh, no. We did not rehearse that.
Perhaps we should have done.
It's just an instant reaction. I didn't know what happened there. What happened? I blacked out.
So Martha Wayne says, do you think Fisk investigating Murdoch equals potential born again for season 3? I imagine it ending like the comic with Cap and Thor. I don't know, because it doesn't really feel like this version of Daredevil hasn't really been, I think, drawing on necessarily or being like a straight adaptation of comic book arcs. And to be honest, Marvel don't do that.
Yeah.
They haven't done Demon in a Bottle for Iron Man. Civil War isn't an adaptation of Civil War. It just takes a name.
Age of Ultron wasn't,
exactly the same. So, you know, forget everything you think you know.
Thanks, Doctor Strange.
This is my extent of my comics knowledge. I read the Wikipedia article for Born Again.
Fascinating.
Apparently, so Karen tries to become an actress and then gets addicted to heroin and then dies at the hands of... Is it the Punisher or one of the villains?
Well, she is a woman in a comic book.
Yeah, I mean, why not? Sure. But that seems like an unusual direction that this series probably wouldn't take. Also, Cap and Thor, I think, probably... It wouldn't go that way around, would it? Daredevil might appear in Avengers movies, but I don't know if I think the Avengers are too A-list to come into the TV world.
I think that for the most part, that's true. Although, we know we have had a couple of... One Nicholas J. Fury did turn up
yes.
in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Shield. It's not beyond the realm. It's just unlikely.
I don't know. We shall see. It's a storyline that's, 30 years old now? I imagine that it would be changed quite a lot if it happened. But... Yeah, it's still worth checking out.
I have a question from Facebook. This is from Brian Mayer, who says, do you feel it was the best decision to keep the Punisher and Elektra's arcs separate? They never meet. Which is an interesting point. They don't meet at any point, do they?
No, well, they don't. It's possibly wise, given that he might be tempted to, you know, shoot her.
Yes. Yes.
So maybe that's why.
That's a very good point.
Get out of the way, Red. She's my girlfriend. We're on a date.
She's a killer.
But you're a killer.
Well,
shades of grey. Semantics.
That's a good point. Maybe he wouldn't.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe they'll reteam in future installments. Connor Walshy on Twitter says, do you think Fisk knows Matt is Daredevil? Which raises an interesting point for me as well. Do you think that Frank knows Matt is Daredevil? It's not like he disguises his voice that much.
Interesting.
Presumably he would have had a chance to peek onto the mask at some point.
Well, he definitely had the chance. He says he didn't take it.
Mm. But, and we believe him because he doesn't tell a lie.
No.
He shoots people in the face, point blank range, doesn't tell a lie.
He's so like George Washington. Anyway, I think Fisk... I think you're right about the scene between Matt and Fisk, and I think it is dangerous to have too much of Fisk's attention on you, and Matt may have drawn a little bit more than he's comfortable with. So I would say that's a bit of a risk for next season. If Fisk is indeed back in a larger role next season, I would be extremely worried if I were Matt Murdock. In terms of Frank, I'm not sure how relevant he'd consider it enough to investigate it. I think if he wanted to find out, he probably could.
Mm.
But I don't know if he would particularly be bothered. He apparently isn't, as things stand.
I did wonder at one point during the trial, Frank's trial, that maybe he would figure it out. The show seemed to be going to a lot to great lengths to keep Matt, the lawyer, and Frank apart. So I thought, the penny's going to drop. And I didn't know that, you know, he's not the sort of person who'd on the stand would go, hey, counselor, you're Daredevil. He's Daredevil, everybody. I don't think that would ever have happened, but I just wondered if it might have provided a nice twist to that relationship, maybe given it a different bit of leverage. Who knows? We'll find out another time.
This is another question from Facebook. Andy Dunbadin, I'm sorry if I've almost certainly said your name wrong, says, who leaves the weapons in the cabin for Frank to find?
Isn't that meant to be his commanding officer's own stash?
Is it?
Right in the woods.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not...
That's the way I read it.
Yeah, it's not Frank's stash. At the end, when he burns down his own house, and he pulls back a painting to reveal a CD that says the word micro, that seems to me to be a reference to Microchip, who is kind of Frank's sidekick, his arms dealer, his tech guy. Traditionally in the comics, they have a very complicated relationship that came to an interesting peak in the Garth Ennis run. But no, otherwise, I think Frank uses that opportunity. I think, in fact, I think it's that moment that he decides to become Punisher. It's that moment where he's made his peace by shooting a special guest star, Clancy Brown.
Yep.
Mid-monologue, which was a nice touch, if you like that sort of thing. You know, not entirely sure that the through line from Clancy Brown showing up in the courtroom scene to him being the big bad guy quite worked for me. Although I know someone who said the minute Clancy Brown turned up, I knew he was the bad guy behind it.
Really?
Because he's Clancy Brown.
That seems ungenerous.
Clancy Brown's played some good guys.
He's played that good guy that one time.
Starship Troopers.
Okay, maybe two times even. He played another good guy recently.
Starship Troopers did.
He played a good guy recently in Sleepy Hollow. Admittedly, he almost immediately got killed. But he was a delight. He was very sweet and was sort of an adoptive father.
He feels like someone who would be on Supernatural. Has he been on Supernatural?
I feel like he has, but I can't swear to it, actually.
I can't believe you don't have an intimate knowledge of over 200 episodes of that show, Helen, so you can pull that sort of stuff out immediately.
No, he hasn't. He hasn't, but he is virtually the only kind of cult actor he hasn't been.
Yeah, but we talked earlier on about, you know, is there a moment where Frank decides that, you know, I'm going to carry on with my crusade, and I think it's when he finds all that sweet, sweet, heavy artillery and the bulletproof vest with the skull on it, and he goes, all right, yeah, well, you know, waste not, want not. Cogni Dubness says, whose character had the better storyline, Punisher or Elektra?
Ooh, Punisher. He just had a couple of episodes head start, I think, which gives him the edge.
I think Punisher for me as well, because John Bernthal, I just think, is a remarkable actor. I think he's got a really good balance between that sort of meathead, tough guy, but also he can play those emotional, tragic family backstory scenes really well. And, you know, that could so easily just be sort of sentimental hogwash, and it's actually pitched really nicely. I really enjoyed those scenes where he's just sort of weeping away.
Yeah.
I thought they were really, really strong.
Yeah, the decision to pair him up with Karen was an interesting one as well. Just a couple more, very, very quickly. Some people reinforcing some of the things we've already talked about. John Carroll, 1988, says, did you think the Punisher storyline was ruined by its rushed ending? I felt he didn't get his due, that's for sure. Death by Jigsaws asks, how many ninjas, exactly the same thing you said, John. How many ninjas do you estimate there really are in NYC? It's hard out here for a ninja. And how did Daredevil Season 2 manage to make them boring? Oh, come on, they're just guys who run around in masks with swords and slowing down their heartbeat every now and again. They don't do a lot of stuff.
I sort of agree with you, Death by Jigsaws. How do you die by a jigsaw?
This is the modern world. I agree with you, Death by Jigsaws. You are hashtag correct.
If I may expand on that, Death by Jigsaw.
How do you die by jigsaw? Didn't you watch any of the Saw films?
That sort of jigsaw. I was thinking, you know, 100 pieces of a dinosaur or something, you know, like a cardboard jigsaw, yeah. You know.
Paper cuts.
Yeah, I did think, we've already covered the ninja thing. I didn't really like the ninjas, to be honest. But the fact that they had their face covered means, you know, you could use the same sort of five extras and over again, really.
But I liked a lot of the stuff with the ninja. I liked like I said already, I liked a bit of, you know, Matt couldn't figure out where they were. It made the fight scenes a little bit more interesting. I loved that moment where he steps out of his bedroom and he gets shot through the chest with an arrow by the ninja who has crept into his room, into his house. And you're kind of going, oh, that's okay.
That sucks.
Yeah. Sucks to be you, Matt Murdock. Comes in tomorrow morning with this sucking chest wound. Your Honor, I'm fine.
Don't ask.
Happy night at Josie's. You know how it is. Like, he's more happy to present himself as this raging alcoholic who gets into the odd scuffle, gets shot through the chest with the odd arrow. Anyway. Very, very last couple of questions. At Harlow C says, any wish lists for season 3?
More Fisk. More Punisher. More crossovers.
Yeah.
We've kind of covered most
of think so. Bullseye.
Bullseye.
Bullseye for me. Has to be Bullseye. And it's interesting you wanted more Fisk, because I was really worried going into this season that we would have nil Fisk. Shout out to, I believe, kitchen supply manufacturer there. is that what that was? And the last question is from at @ha_Marleys. The question is, any personal standout scenes a la the hallway fight from season 1?
Well, yeah, I mean, the obvious one is the hallway fight. I mean, it's the stairway fight this time, isn't it? It's on multiple levels, but it's the same vibe and it's the same, you know, single take concept. And obviously, some people have criticised it because you can see the joins this time. I mean, they've clearly stitched together a few shots. But
I'm going to be able to do a one take fight down.
Of course not. Of course
on a
not.
TV
I'm
schedule.
Totally. I'm totally fine with that. I think the ends justify the means because it looks damn cool.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
It looks amazing, and it also. Did you notice how close the camera was into that action? Like really riding shotgun with Daredevil, and it makes it so exciting. Yeah, I absolutely loved it.
Mm.
And it also, just as a sort of wider point, I thought visually the series was really strong. I thought it was very confident. I thought it was directed very well. throughout.
Yeah, by, again, a disparate number of directors. Mm. I mean, lots of people, including Steven Sergic, who is the director of Wayne's World 2.
No
and
way.
Directed the episode actually I was on set for, which was episode, I want to say 11 or 12. I can't quite remember.
I think
remember.
It was 11. It was the boat one, wasn't it?
The boat one, yeah. Episode 11. So I was there for the scene where Frank confronts the bloke in the boat that he thinks is the blacksmith. And then Daredevil comes in and says, hey, man, this killing doesn't work out. And it's like, oh. So that was a fun scene. But yeah, Steven Sergic.
Mm.
Yeah, very, very interesting. I think I've talked about it, most of the Electra Matt stuff. I love the end of, I think it's episode 5, where she lures him to her apartment and then basically hands him his costume and goes, oh, I know who you are, so there's lots of ninjas coming, they're going to kill us, so we might as well suit up and get it on. It's all very, very cool. And I love Scott Glenn's stick. I think anything with him in it is immediately elevated. Yeah. And more Rosario Dawson. I think we need more Rosario Dawson. Mm.
You've been saying that for about the last 10 years, though, Chris.
I said even in a number of contexts.
Yeah,
yes.
In contexts that have nothing to do with film or TV.
Yeah, it's just in strange. A restaurant. So we don't have that on the menu, I'm afraid.
No, you didn't understand me. I want more Rosario Dawson. I want it now, or I will give you 2 stars in TripAdvisor. More Rosario Dawson as Claire Temple. I presume she'll show up in Iron Fist and Luke Cage as well.
Yeah, let's hope.
And I liked Melvin as well, who makes those funky new duds, which are better than the slightly unfunky duds at the end of season one.
But is he going the wrong way? Obviously, in the comics, he is, you know.
Yeah.
He's a badden.
He's a badden. A misguided badden.
He's so lovely at the moment, so I hope he continues on the right path.
But I think his repeated reminders to Matt that Betsy is very important. We must keep Betsy alive. We must protect Betsy. I think Betsy is not long for this world. And Melvin is going to blame Matt Murdock for some reason. In some way, for what happens to Betsy. I mean, Anvil's dropping people all the time.
Yeah, it does seem to be going that way, doesn't it?
Yeah. Right. I think we've covered everything. If we haven't, feel free to throw tomatoes at your podcast listening device of choice.
Be aware that if you do throw tomatoes at an electronic device, it may impair that device's function. We take no responsibility for that.
Good point. Check your warranty before you throw anything at your podcast listening device of choice. And that is it for this Daredevil Season 2 Spoilers Special. Join us every Friday for the regular podcast and keep your ears peeled for future Spoilers Specials. Our extensive back catalogue of Spoilers Specials is, as ever, at your fingertips. Most recently, Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice with Zack Snyder, Deborah Snyder and Chuck Roven. Before that, Deadpool with Ryan Reynolds. Before that, Star Wars The Force Awakens with Lawrence Kasdan. I could go on. Coming up next, we have Captain America Civil War with the Russo brothers, Anthony and Joe, and X-Men Apocalypse with Bryan Singer and Simon Kinberg. Very, very excited about both of those, and we hope that you can join us. Until then, it is goodbye from John.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. Thanks for listening. Bye.